Ladies and gentlemen, if I may just ask for some moments, or indeed some minutes of silence, because the serious part is now about to begin. The whole of the last day and a half have really just been a build-up for Jim to explain the new narrative. And I'm sure I can't be the only person to think that there's something slightly Orwellian in this term, the new narrative. We think about newspeak, which George Orwell made very famous in the novel 1984. And I'm sure that within a few years, all references to the old narrative, old speak, will just disappear from all the memory banks and all the websites, and there'll be no more references to this at all. But of course, we benefited very much from having Chris Waller, who seems to be the Boswell to your Johnson, who seems to be your muse, your inspiration, or maybe it was the other way around, telling us a little bit yesterday about how the new narrative came about. So over to you, Jim, to tell us about the brave new narrative.
Okay, thanks very much. So since we've been at this conference over the last day and a half, I got a lot of questions about this. So I thought that I'd give this opening statement, which is just running through some slides on how we've changed our approach to monetary policy. Some of you may have seen it before, but I thought we'd just level set everybody and then can do questions. Certainly happy, I think, during the main Q&A, we'll probably do talk about a lot of other things, but I thought I'd just run through this so that we can kind of level set on this. So the St. Louis Fed has changed its approach to near-term U.S. macroeconomic and monetary policy projections, and you can check out the speech I gave in the UK on June 30th. We also had a released statement on June 17th. I also used these exact slides just a few days ago here in St. Louis. So I've been talking about it in various locations. And the idea is that we had an older narrative that we think has now outlived its usefulness, so we're replacing it with the, I don't think it's quite as Orwellian as you might think. It's actually just the right time to change narratives. And so I'm going to talk just about the two differences between these. So I'm going to go a little faster maybe than I would usually use for these slides, but I just wanted to have a chance to run through this. So let's just look at what the old narrative was. The old narrative that we were using took it as axiomatic that there's a long-run steady state, and this long-run steady state is some kind of average of the past, and all key variables are then converging eventually to their long-run steady state values. And in addition to that, the idea that the business cycle has kind of run its course for this, at least until the next recession, and that gaps have basically gone down to zero. Certainly unemployment in the U.S. at 4.9% is more or less right on top of what the committee thinks is the natural rate of unemployment. And so with no gaps and everything needing to go back to historical average values, that must mean that the policy rate has to also go back to its historical value. And in our old narrative, this was the reason why we had a rising rate path in the notorious dot plot, which I know David loves the dot plot. And so a lot of this is about what is it about that dot plot that is working or not working. You've got an upward sloping dot plot, but you've got a market that it continually has expected a very flat pace of increases in the policy rate in the U.S. And it's not just that the market is at the low end of the dot plot. The market is way below every single dot. So it's not like they're just trying to price in the, a few dovish members or something. No, they're way below everybody. So why is that? And I think it might have something to do with this long-run steady state idea. Now, in the new narrative, we're going to throw out this concept of a single long-run steady state. We're going to abandon that, and we're going to replace that with a set of possible regimes that the economy may visit. So it's a lot of pretty good economists here and are probably very familiar with the so-called nonlinear econometrics literature pioneered by Jim Hamilton, so-called regime switching literature. You can also check out the book by Kim and Nelson, kind of the Bible of regime switching. So the nomenclature of a regime, which maybe doesn't sound that good outside of economics, but this is all within econometrics. So this is about means of variables and switching between means of variables and things like that. And these regimes are normally viewed as persistent. They wouldn't always have to be persistent, but they're viewed as persistent. And if you're going to switch to a different regime, that's viewed as something that isn't very forecastable. So once you're in a regime, the simplest thing, at least for the near term, a couple of years, would be to say, well, you're probably going to stay in that regime. You understand that you might switch at some point in the future, but you think of the regime as being very persistent and as switches as not being forecastable. And a key thing is that when it comes time for policy then, you should think of, well, what regime am I in, and then make policy optimally for that regime, because you're probably going to be in the regime for the foreseeable future. So you should make policy for the regime, not for the long-run steady state that you, in the previous narrative, you were always converging to the long-run steady state. Here, you're just in this regime. You might as well make policy consistent with that regime. So the upshot of this, if you don't want to listen and want to eat instead, the upshot is that the policy rate in this new narrative would likely remain essentially flat over the forecast horizon and remain consistent with the current regime. So here's the forecast that we get out of this. Real GDP growth just stays at around 2% over the forecast horizon. Unemployment rate stays at 4.7%. It ticked up in the last jobs report, but we still have our 4.7%. Trim mean PC inflation rate, 2% over the forecast horizon. And then the policy rate just goes up once to 63 basis points, stays at 63 basis points out over the next 2.5 years. So that's what you get. Associated with that are some risks that are likely to the upside. So we're describing a policy rate path which is very flat, but which may, if certain things happen, you know, you may end up with a higher rate path, but that's not what we're projecting for our baseline. Okay, so let's just talk briefly about this previous narrative, the one we're throwing away. How did that work? Well, previously, in the last 5 years, we would always say the same thing. We pretended that we were changing, but we were saying the same thing over and over, which was growth is going to be above trend. That's going to drive unemployment down. Inflation is going to eventually rise to 2% and then go above 2%. It's going to overshoot. We were one of the few banks that had the overshooting. And then the policy rate will have to increase to be consistent with the unique steady state. So we had an upward sloping policy rate path. And some aspects of this worked well. If you look from the second half of 2013 up until now, that would be a two-year time frame. Up until a year ago, that would be a two-year time frame. Quarterly growth rate was 2.7%. That was higher than trend. And indeed, unemployment came down about 2 percentage points during that period. On the inflation side, we didn't really get what we expected. Inflation barely moved. So now might be a good time to throw out this old narrative because its usefulness may have come to an end. Output growth, instead of being above trend in the last year, has not been above trend. It's actually been a little bit below our trend. Unemployment is probably unlikely now to be declining a lot further. And trim mean inflation has come up almost all the way to target, and it has not been rising rapidly. So if there are no major shocks to the economy, and of course all kinds of things could happen, but if there are no major shocks, this situation could be sustained over a forecasting horizon of 2 to 2.5 years. So here's the GDP numbers from mid-2013 to mid-2015. averaging about 2.7% with a lot of volatility. These are quarterly averages. In the last year, that's the lower horizontal bar there in the middle of the graph, only averaging about 1.6%. That's even with some improvement in the just past quarter. We're using a tracking estimate for the second quarter. The Atlanta Fed, the notorious Atlanta Fed GDP Now forecast as of July 6th. So, but even if you throw that in there, GDP growth in the last year has only been 1.6%. So we're projecting just 2% growth out over the forecast horizon. And by the way, one of the consequences of going to this regime switching framework is we don't have a long-run dot. So we don't say anything about long-run steady state anymore, because the economy is characterized by regimes that can be visited from time to time. It doesn't make sense to average across all those and call that a long-run steady state anymore. Here's the unemployment rate. It has indeed fallen, but the green line there shows the 2006 to 2007 average. So that was at the last part of the last expansion, arguably a bubble. That only averaged about 4.6%. So maybe it's time to quit forecasting further declines in unemployment, as long as growth isn't, I mean, if growth was 4 or 5%, then I might come back in and say, well, maybe that's going to drive unemployment down further. But it's not. It looks like growth has slowed over the last year. So we just projected out 4.7% unemployment over the forecast horizon. And here's Dallas Fed trim mean inflation with our inflation target there. It has been creeping up. The latest values are around 1.85% year over year. So we're projecting that just to go up to 2 and stay there. So this new narrative is based on regime switching. So what we want to do is break down the idea of a long-run steady state. We want a manageable expression of the uncertainty surrounding medium and longer-term outcomes. And these regimes are going to be driven by fundamental factors. Productivity growth is one factor. Real interest rate on short-term government debt is another factor. And state of the business cycle is a third factor. And forecast horizon will be limited to just 2.5 years. So let's talk about productivity growth. That's been very slow, at least since 2011. We're going to call this a low productivity growth regime. We're going to assume we will remain in that regime through the forecasting horizon. Higher labor productivity growth has been observed in the recent past. It's always possible we could return to that regime. But that we're just going to count that as an upside risk. We're not going to use that as our baseline case for the purposes of forecasting. So here's the picture. Here's the current regime. This is year-over-year labor productivity growth over the last 3 years. Only paltry 0.4%, so not very impressive. Here's the 1995 2005 average. So there is a better world out there, if only we would go back to that. But we're not, for purposes of forecasting, I don't think it's prudent to say, oh, we're going to jump back up to that situation. So we're going to assume we're in this low productivity growth and therefore low output growth situation for the foreseeable future. And our goal is to make a good monetary policy given that fact. Now, how about the second fundamental factor, which is the real return on government debt, which we're provocatively calling R dagger, which I thought David would really like, the R dagger. This is to distinguish it from the R star that's been discussed around here at this conference and widely getting a lot of play based on the work of Thomas Lalbach and John Williams. This is just the real rate of return on short-term government debt. It's been exceptionally low. We're going to call this a low real rate regime. Appears to be highly persistent. So again, for forecasting purposes, we're just going to say, what, you know, this is R dagger. It's just going to, it's low, and it's going to stay low. And Chris Waller yesterday devoted his remarks to talking about this and had some good charts, which I should have in here, but I don't. So we know that this could move higher, but we're going to view that as a risk. And we're going to interpret this as an abnormally high liquidity premium on government debt. Real returns to capital are not low, as Chris Waller was saying yesterday. So it's not a matter of all the returns in the economy are low, as they would be in a new Keynesian interpretation. It's just that the real rate of return on government debt is low, and we don't see any reason to forecast that's going to go away. So here's the picture. Here is the ex post real return on government debt, the blue line. That's the one-year Treasury nominal yield minus the Dallas Fed trim mean year-over-year PC inflation rate over the last 3 years. That average is minus 141 basis points. We see no reason for that to change anytime soon, so we're going to forecast that to continue. But look at the other regime, the high dotted green line that you're probably barely noticing here on this chart. That is the average from January 1984 to December 2007, 2.7%. It's a huge number of basis points higher than where we are today. So we're obviously in this very low real interest rate environment. We're expecting it to persist going forward. Finally, the third fundamental is the possibility of recession. We're going to assume we're in a no recession regime, at least for now. Here's a picture that shows that we like that tries to predict recession probabilities. It's barely off zero, so we don't think there's any reason to predict a recession over the forecast horizon, so we're going to predict that we stay out of recession. So what does it mean for the policy rate path? Now that you're done eating, you can start paying attention again. The Taylor rule in our framework then would have gaps in it, but we're saying the gaps are essentially zero, so that's not contributing very much in your Taylor rule, and that would just leave this Fisher equation, I equals R dagger plus expected inflation, and expected inflation should be 2%, or we'd like it to be 2%, and that means that because the R dagger is so small, means that the policy rate only has to be 63 basis points in order to hit the inflation target over the forecast horizon. So so this is how we got to this this conclusion. And here's the picture. This is kind of the money slide here. There is the actual policy rate since July of 2013. You can see the rise in the U.S. policy rate on the blue line last December. The green dots are the median of the FOMC's summary of economic projections for the policy rate. The red dots are the St. Louis Fed's new projection going forward. So it does lead to a stark difference in this picture. Now, there are risks to this forecast. I'm almost done here. The risk is you could switch to the new regime. Then all bets would be off. You'd have to pursue policy appropriately for the new regime. There's also a risk that there'd be more meaningful Phillips curve effects than we've got in here. We kind of downplay the Phillips curve. We don't think those effects are very strong. But it could be that the Phillips curve would reassert itself and inflation would go up. We'd have to react to that. Inflation expectations, which I often talk about, are actually too low to be consistent with this scenario. And we are concerned about that, but we just put that as a risk to this forecast. And of course, there's asset price bubbles. We are concerned about those too, but there's nothing in here really about asset price bubbles. So this is the end of it. Here's a one slide that can give you the whole picture here. But what we're talking about, you start on the left, then you, for the purposes of a baseline forecast, we're going to assume that there's no reason to forecast a recession. So we'll go to the no recession state. And then on R dagger, we're going to assume we're in the low R dagger regime. So we're going to pick that one. And then for productivity, we're in the low lambda regime, which is the low productivity growth regime. And that gives us our baseline forecast, which is boxed over there on the right side of this picture. But these things could switch to higher values. It's possible. That would be upside risk to the policy rate path. But we're just treating that as an upside risk, and we're not putting that in the baseline forecast. Obviously, you could also go into recession. That would be the downside here, but we don't have any reason to forecast a recession at this point. So the conclusion is that the policy rate path is the main difference here. In the old narrative, we got a steep policy rate path, which was dictated by convergence to a single long-run steady state. In the new narrative, we get a flat policy rate path conditional on the current regime. If a regime switch does occur, then we gotta change. But for now, that's the new approach and the new narrative. So thank you, David. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Do you want to have a bite to eat, or should we just go straight in?
We can go in if you want to. Sure.
Neil, to eat. So thank you very much, Jim. Jim is not going to eat much food. He's giving new meaning to the phrase mean and trim, I would say. So thank you very much, Jim, for giving us that exposition. I'm very pleased that I can welcome also Neil Kashkari up here. Now, Neil is the new president of the Minneapolis Fed. I'm not sure what the collective noun is for two central bankers from the FOMC, whether it should be just a common word like brace. It can't be a bubble. There's not enough for you to be a bubble. I would call you a conundrum of central bankers. That is the new collective noun for two of you. I will introduce Neil in a moment. But first of all, Jim, I just want to say that the last time we met, you were using a lot of sporting metaphors. This was in Singapore and China. And you rather told me off because I started to talk about the crowd invading the pitch and so on. You said no more footballing metaphors. But I didn't know you were going to be setting up a whole new narrative. You've obviously been using your time very well. I mean, this is totally revolutionary, I would say. What did the board itself say? Did you let Janet know about this beforehand, or did you just launch this on the FOMC?
Well, over the last 6 months, maybe sliding a little more dovish, or I've been wanting to talk in a different way about our dot plot, because the dot plot has consistently been saying that we're going to take off and that there is, you know, upwards of 200 basis points of tightening just around the corner. But since the end of QE, which, you know, essentially was the last part of 2014, we've actually, the committee has only moved once, and the market-based probabilities that will move even in the rest of this year below 50% might only be about 30% right now. So what we're doing is moving at a pace of one rate hike per year on a program, which would eventually require, at least in our narrative, would have required 350 basis points of moves. So it would take 14 years to get from where we are up 350 basis points at the rate we're moving. And I just thought that that's just wildly inconsistent with how business cycles work and how policy works. So if you're not actually doing that, then you should think of some reasons, you know, some better way to describe what's going on, and we thought maybe this would be a better description. Often if you talk to people, like people in this room, about that long-run steady state, and you ask them, how confident are you about that long-run steady state? People will often come back and say, well, I don't know. I have no idea. I have a lot of uncertainty around that long-run steady state. Mm-hmm. And then you say, well, but what you're projecting is just a mean reversion back to that steady state, and, you know, that's a puzzler for most people. So the regime switching is a way to break that apart in a manageable way and talk about it in a different way. So
I'll ask Neil in a moment what he thinks about that. But first of all, just one other point. Also, you didn't actually say whether you discussed this, first of all, with Janet. Was it a surprise for Janet Yellen? Because it seems like you're changing the whole way the FOMC approaches
things. Well, I don't know. I gave public comments where at one point I said I was thinking of unilaterally pulling out of the dot plot. Mm. So I guess it's not a surprise.
Yeah.
I thought maybe that wasn't the best way to go. But we did pull out of one aspect, which is that long run dot. We didn't put the long run dot in there because we didn't think that was an appropriate way to think about things.
I must say I've changed my view that I don't think this is Orwellian any longer. You used another number of phrases which struck me. This could have been Captain Kirk in Star Wars. You said the economy is characterized by various regimes, which we will visit from time to time. You said we're going to break down the long-run steady state. And even better, you said there is a better world out there if only we could jump to it. So this is classic Star Wars, isn't it, basically?
Well, on the...
We have a prime directive as well.
I will say that the... You've seen higher productivity in the past, so this isn't as pessimistic as the sort of secular stagnation story. This is just that we happen to be in a low productivity growth regime. It's possible, given all the technological developments that are happening and technological diffusion that's happening, that you would return to a higher productivity regime. We don't really have much theory about that, and furthermore, we don't think monetary policy can do that much about it. So for the purposes of forecasting and setting monetary policy, we take that as an input to our process, not an output.
Well, let's bring you, Neil, into this. You're an aerospace engineer, so you're used to all this highfalutin jargon. And it seems to me that Jim has done a wonderful service by basically bringing in a whole load of algebra just to try to cover up the fact that the market was right. but I might just ask you this point. You've had a whole series of different careers, and you've just joined now the FOMC since January. You've been an investment banker. You had this amazing experience at the Treasury when you were running the TARP program. You were working for PIMCO. You had an experience also in California, running for the governorship. I've just discovered that I and you and Arnie Schwarzenegger, who would have been your predecessor but one, had you won the governorship, we all have the same birthday on the 30th of July, which is absolutely amazing coincidence. It's also something out of Star Wars, I would say. Only, of course, you are fitter and better looking than either myself or Arnie. But what do you make of all this? You've just joined, and now he's ripped up your steady state. What do you do anymore at the FOMC meetings? Do you just discuss the latest Jim Bullard theorem, or is there anything else that you discuss?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I actually really appreciate Jim's contribution here, because as I am new to the FOMC and an engineer, not an economist, and I look at the analysis that we get before every meeting. We get about 100 pages. We call it the Teal Book of analysis prepared by the Board of Governors. It's economic data and forecasts. Mean reversion is the religion of the Fed. All these charts I look at and I ask our economists, why do they all have the same shape? They all kind of go back to the way we hope things are. And so I really appreciate the fact that Jim is challenging that religion and forcing us to ask more fundamental questions. I don't know if Jim is right. I don't know when the regime would switch and what will cause it to switch, but I think he's asking good questions that he's forcing us to think, and I think that's a real contribution.
Who are us? I mean, how many people agree with the new Bullardian approach to the universe?
Well, I think all of us look at the data, and the data is unmistakable. For the last few years, we've been wrong. Our forecasts have not been what the economy has actually produced, so that's irrefutable. And so anybody who's looking at the data objectively would have to say, well, what we've been doing has not worked. The question is, are we humble enough to ask, should we try something different? And I think that's what Jim is, in his way, is asking us to consider.
And you've obviously set down, Jim, a number of things to look at in terms of moving away from the basic regime in terms of productivity growth, in terms of recession, in terms of shocks and so on. How likely, you know, looking into the future, how likely do you think that over the next couple of years there will be something during this two-year forecasting period that will seriously disturb this one regime that you're setting out as a new steady state?
Well, the whole idea is that as a baseline case, you should assume that, you know, probably things aren't going to change. Then you cross your fingers and you say, well, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we got the higher labor productivity growth or GDP growth surprised to the upside, or unemployment, you know, went down further, or whatever. But that isn't the way you should think about the baseline case. I think that's the basic story here.
What about the international economy, Neil? You've been working in an environment, also in investment banking, and certainly in the Treasury, where you had to be very mindful of the international environment. They came up also with Rob Kaplan yesterday, the extent to which the Fed, in its public statements, is very overtly taking into account the international environment. We mentioned last night the number of times Janet Yellen mentions China, for example. Do you think this new model, which certainly does give leeway for risks and perturbations from outside, do you think that's also a very effective way of showing the rest of the world that the Fed is the central bank of the United States, but the Fed certainly cares about the rest of the world? Do you think that's all implicit in, in this new way of looking at things.
Well, I'm not sure if Jim's regime switching affects how we think about the world. I think, as Rob said last night, the world is a really important input into the U.S. economy. So our mission on behalf of the American people is to look out for the U.S. economy, our dual mandate, which you're familiar with. But to the extent that the world affects the U.S. economy, we care a great deal about that. But we also have to look around the experiences. You know, one of the things, for years, experts around the world have been pointing the finger at the Bank of Japan and saying the Bank of Japan just has missed it. They've been late. They've not been sufficiently bold. If only they had gotten bolder earlier, the Japanese outcome of their economy would have been different. I think we know enough now to question that confidence that things would be so different if only the Bank of Japan had been more aggressive earlier. I mean, Japan has demographic changes that we've talked about here, real challenges that I think we in the rest of the world can learn from. And so maybe in Jim's framework, Japan is in a different regime than others had appreciated, and it's not simply the fact that their monetary authorities had been insufficiently aggressive. And so I think we can learn from that. And if Japan can make policy changes to shift to a better regime, you know, I think that they'd be better off for that.
I mean, I think that's fairly standard now that one says that Japan was not aggressive enough for all sorts of political or socio-cultural reasons. But I've heard you say in the past, Jim, that various people on the FOMC are rather haunted by the idea that in, say, 2004, 2005, that the Fed didn't react aggressively enough in tightening. I know we're not talking about that scenario now, but over the next 2 or 3 years, do you think it's totally ruled out that we will get back to a regime whereby we suddenly do start to get worried about the classic central banker fear of higher inflation? Or do you think that's now more or less off the table for this 2 to 3 year period, shall we say?
No, I think it's an upside risk at this point because, you know, unemployment has come down. It still could go down further. Could be that you'll get, you know, these Phillips curve effects will come back and inflation will go higher. You've got the energy prices now look like stabilizing, even rising maybe, and possibly that could push inflation higher than what we have it, push it above target, and the Fed would have to react in that kind of circumstance. But I want to think about it as an upside risk that we can react to and not as a baseline case that would require us to, you know, put this policy rate path on an upward slope on the grounds that our baseline case is that inflation.
Would you like to put a probability on whether that risk could return, say, in the next 2 to 3 years, you know, 10%, 20%?
No, I don't want to put
it I was absolutely amazed you even thought about it. I want to open this up to the audience, and I would like to close in about 10 minutes because I know some of you have got planes to catch and so on. But first of all, just one remark to you both about the international environment, which after all is very important. We just had a bit of a shock in the United Kingdom, although nobody really knows what the British are going to do on all this. I'm the only British person, I think, in the room. I've got absolutely no idea, so I can speak for Britain here. But this has certainly led to a sharp fall in the pound. The dollar has gone up again, trade-weighted. The euro has gone up in a trade-weighted way, which is not very helpful for the European economy. There seems to be a lot of competitive devaluations going on around the world. The dollar is supreme. Do you think we could get into a position whereby the dollar's strength, which it has been now pretty strong for the last 2 or 3 years, starts to be a real worry for the United States recovery and for your very impressive manufacturing industry, for example?
Well, again, it's something we pay close attention to. We're not actively targeting the dollar, but it's a feedback loop for our decisions. Monetary policy divergence expresses itself oftentimes through currencies, and so sometimes it can be a headwind and work against us. So it's something we pay attention to, but I wouldn't say more than that. Hmm.
And then we've been talking a lot in the last day and a half about competition between currencies. We've had some fantastic conversations also about the renminbi, the slow rise of the renminbi. One of the reasons why the euro was set up, at least many people in Germany felt this, was to provide a bit of competition to the dollar. And I think the Chinese very much saw the euro as being a very useful tool for diversification. So there wouldn't just be the one game in town, the dollar. It's like... Yeah. An airline business doesn't have to just buy Boeing, you can buy Airbus as well. Would you, as a central banker, Jim, would you actually welcome a bit more really genuine competition from really serious grown-up currencies around the world, because the euro is still going through a stage of slightly infantile stage, I might say. The euro hasn't really quite grown up.
I think there's some discipline maybe that comes through that process. I think it's a slow process to become the world's reserve currency. I think you could think about the replacement of sterling by the dollar in the early part of the 20th century. Takes a long time, you know, many decades, and the euro got started, maybe had a good first decade, maybe not such a good second decade. So it's part of a very long run process. I think what's unusual, just reflecting on the last session that we had, is that we're envisioning a future. I mean, think of the 19th century and the 20th century as more or less the largest economy, or the hegemon was the one that had the reserve currency, if you want to think of it that way. And for what we're envisioning is a future where that may not be true if the RMB does not sort of open up more significantly and trade, have a flexible exchange rate and so on and so forth. And is that, how feasible is that? And is that a realistic way to think about the future where the reserve currency would not be associated with the largest economy? I don't think we've had much experience with that, although historians might be able to tell me.
Well, we certainly had it the other way around. Sterling was still the world's reserve currency long after Britain had lost its pula status.
But that was a consequence of the size of the British Empire and the vast trading network that the empire had.
Yes. Yeah. And just last point for you, Neil, before we do open it up to the audience, and I've got to see Peter, maybe we can have a microphone in Peter's direction. You've just joined the FOMC, a member of the Federal Reserve. Do you think in your lifetime, and you're a young, fit man, in your lifetime, do you think any other currency will replace the dollar as the world's supreme currency?
In my lifetime, it's possible. But to the question you asked, Jim, it'd be good for the U.S. if the euro were a very strong currency and a strong economic union and was vibrant. That'd be net positive for the U.S. And if China opens its markets and its currency becomes a part of the global reserve currency system and is very credible, that's going to be good for the world economy. It'll be good for the U.S. So I don't think, nobody in America is betting or hoping against the euro or hoping against the RMB. It'll be good for the U.S. if these economic systems thrive.
That's very, very good positive note. So bring it on, rather Clint Eastwood-like, make my day. Peter.
Thank you. I enjoyed very much your presentation, Mr. Bullard, but I'm not convinced. If your second scenario, the new narrative, is accepted by the FOMC, it's of extremely grave, serious consequences for this country and for the whole world. So let me ask you a question, why I'm not convinced. It seems to me that the basic difference between the old scenario and the new scenario is a set of assumptions that you're making about GDP growth and productivity growth. That essentially turns the GDP growth and productivity growth into exogenous variables. Suppose you're wrong on that. Suppose these so-called GDP and productivity assumptions are in fact not exogenous, but in fact influenced by your monetary policy. What about it? The entire base for your new scenario is a set of assumptions.
Okay, we get the point.
Surely you would not argue that monetary policy can control real GDP growth over the medium term or unemployment.
Well, I don't think we know.
The business cycle fluctuations stemming from the 2007 to 2009 shock have dissipated. So now we're at trend, more or less. And going forward, you should just think of us as being a trend. Something will happen, a shock will happen, but we don't know what that is. So for that trend, what's the right monetary policy? That's how we want to think about it. So we're no longer in an environment where we could realistically expect unemployment to decline further. we're no longer in an environment where we can realistically expect a burst of growth stemming from past monetary stimulus or anything like that. All of that has gone away. So now what we should project, and the trend growth rate seems to be pretty low. So now what we should think about starting today is 2% growth, 4.7% inflation. By the way, those numbers, those three numbers, inflation, growth, and unemployment, are, as far as a forecast, are not very different from what the private sector forecast is. What's different here is the interpretation and the policy rate path.
I mean, I think we should give the guy a break. His new narrative is only a few weeks old. Then you're tearing it apart already. I know what would happen to you in 1984. Please, Rasmus.
Yeah, thank you. Just a quick question also on the new narrative. When you say the regimes you're in...
You seem to be looking at Neil, but you're really talking... Are you talking to them both, or what?
Yeah. Whichever
one. You're a member of the new narrative now. You've been squared. You're in the picture. You're in the frame.
So you cannot forecast when you switch between them. So yeah. You make policy for the regime you think you're in. There are two things. If you had more information about the past, you could have transition probabilities. If you had those probabilities, would you say that then you wouldn't just make policy for that, you would take out some insurance that you might jump? The other one is you cannot be 100% sure that you're in that regime, so there's some uncertainty. So the basic question is how much should you take out insurance against jumps or being in a different regime?
Yeah. Those are great questions, and if you wrote down a detailed model, I have done research on this kind of stuff. If you wrote down a detailed model, you could get estimates of how much you should take those kinds of things into account when making policy. But I think for purposes of conveying this, you just want to think about, okay, we're in the regime, we're going to make policy for that regime. There is chances of switching, and you would have to take that into account. Yeah.
Good. I think we need a new narrative for the euro, but that's another conference. Joe.
Jim, Neil mentioned the mean reversionary bias of the Fed in general. And some regime switching frameworks take into account that the duration of the regime matters and it actually influences the probability of switching. Does this framework incorporate duration as a factor, or are there just fixed probabilities that switch?
Well, if you put a 0.9 probability that you'll sort of continuation probability on a regime, then it would imply that there'd be some switch out there in the future. There'd be a mean switch time, and you'd have. Neil would love all this stuff because he's an engineer. A lot of this comes out of the engineering, so the that's all in there. But not all regimes are persistent. So a recession regime is not persistent because recessions only last, even bad recessions only last 18 months or 2 years or something. So when you go into the recession regime, the first thing you project is how fast are we going to come out of the recession? But the low productivity regime is probably very persistent, and the low real interest rate regime, as Chris was saying yesterday, real interest rates on government paper have been coming down for 30 years. So why should you project mean reversion there? That doesn't seem to make that much sense. So the regime makes a lot of sense there and looks very persistent.
So final question. It doesn't have to be about the new narrative, Seth.
By the way, before we go to this final question, you know, on other matters, Neil's been a great leader on Too Big to Fail, and I know some of you have followed this a little bit. So he started, when he came in as president of the Minneapolis Fed, wanted to take on this issue and set up these symposia. And I've actually been kind of reverse roles here. I was kind of tagging along and trying to learn more about Too Big to Fail by going to those. But I think those have been excellent discussions of the state of the debate on Too Big to Fail. Really helped me to see, to have protagonists actually bring their argument in and then have the critics come in and say what was wrong with it. So I think it's done a lot to level set everybody on where we are in the Too Big to Fail debate. And so I just wanted to, I didn't want to let this discussion go without mentioning that, because I think that's been a great thing.
Thank you.
This is a quick question from Seth, and we'll also have a quick question from Athanasios, and then we'll close it.
So what I think is interesting, having these two Reserve Bank presidents up, Neil's predecessor, Narayana Kuchelkota, had wrote a Damascus moment where all of a sudden he said, and I think in a strong parallel to what Jim has done here, we had a view of the world, the data started coming in for a long time, contrary to what our view of the world is, and he made a large switch in his view of what monetary policy is. Jim completely changed the narrative in how the St. Louis Fed is thinking. What was newsworthy about both of those events is that it's out of character for the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is very cautious, very gradual, tends never to admit having made a mistake. Revisions to forecasts are fine, but sort of saying, oh, we were wrong, it tends not to happen. And so if you think of some of the big monetary policy mistakes, like in the 70s, there was too long an adherence to a belief in sort of estimate parameter estimates about the Phillips curve or that sort of thing. So the question is, given that we've got presidents of the reserve banks that actually have thrown out the bathwater and hopefully not the baby, how likely do you think it is that the FOMC would be able to recognize in time that they were making a policy mistake if they were making one? So inflation is finally starting to move back up, but we believe in general as an economics profession that inflation is very inertial in the United States. How big is the risk of a massive overshoot in inflation? On the other hand, inflation has been below 2% now for 3.5 years. We might be going off to a bad equilibrium. Given how gradual and how inertial the FOMC tends to be, how big is that risk that they're not going to be able to recognize in time?
Okay, we'll start off by asking Neil to answer that, but a very quick point from Athanasios.
Yeah, I think it would be good to combine this question. Mm. So my question is also for Neil, but drawing on what Jim presented. And if it's one thing I've learned from the presentation that I think would be consistent with the old and the new regime, is that we are way too uncertain about the long-term equilibrium, real rate, whether we call it our star or whether we call it our dagger. And the one really great thing beyond dispute in my mind that I think you started, Jim, is actually saying we should not be putting those dots there. They're not useful. We're just confusing markets in suggesting certainty about something we don't know.
Well, you have stopped doing it.
So the question for Neil is: so given this argument, why is the rest of the committee still putting out those long-term dots? I would have felt more comfortable to say that if it's one thing that has outlived its usefulness, it's the dot plot. So at least we could start by no longer showing this long-term equilibrium real rate, since we're so uncertain about it.
So I'll offer my opinion on both questions. First, I think the risk of an overshoot, an out-of-control overshoot, is nil. Because we may disagree about different things around the committee, but there's nobody in the committee who's going to tolerate inflation getting out of control. And we have complete tools to deal with that. So I don't lose any sleep over us losing control of inflation on the upside. The bigger risk is that we continue to undershoot and we stay in Jim's, or maybe even under Jim's the current regime. And that's why I appreciate what the contribution that he's making to make sure that doesn't happen. And the good news is recent inflation data is at least creeping in the right direction. So hopefully we won't be facing that. In terms of the dot plot, I'm sympathetic with the concerns that you've expressed. But I also am sympathetic with the fact that you don't make these kind of changes lightly. Number one, let's say we eliminated the dot plot. Some could be concerned that we're reducing transparency with the public and with the markets, and there'd be concerns about that. The second thing is when you make these big fundamental communication changes, just like the introduction of the dot plot was a risky move for the committee before I joined, because you're not exactly sure how markets are going to interpret it. You're not sure if it's going to accomplish your objectives. And you're even less sure, is it going to accomplish your objectives in a range of different economic environments? And so I think the committee is reluctant to make fundamental changes in the way it communicates to the markets and will only do so with great care and thoughtfulness, because you can have unintended consequences. And so I agree, the dot plot is not perfect. I have my own concerns about it. But I also am sympathetic with, let's take our time before we just pull it away and then maybe replace it with something maybe better or not. I don't know.
Just a final question, Jim, wrapping up, we do need to stop fairly soon, but also mindful of the fact that the Fed does have a wider mandate, and you mentioned the financial stability aspect, which we've not discussed, the too big to fail and so on, which is an enormous part of all this. We were told yesterday by Rob Kaplan that central banks need to change their game in terms of communication. This is something for the world, not just yourselves. We're getting used to all sorts of shibboleths that are no longer going to be adhered to, take central bank balance sheets. They are going to remain historically very large for a very long period of time everywhere. To what extent, you've made this very valuable contribution, it seems now, which I term as revolutionary change. Maybe it's more gradual than that, but you've made that contribution. To what extent do you think central banks around the world are going to have to rethink not just the way they communicate what they do, but the way they do things and the way they think about things, bearing in mind we are in a long period of low interest rates, low growth, low productivity. So what you have unleashed here, it seems to me, has got some wider general points.
Well, one thing that might be helpful is that there's been so much pressure on central banks since the crisis around the world, and central bankers from Ben Bernanke and everyone else and Mario Draghi have said, well, you know, we need help, we need other kinds of policies, you need to focus on what monetary policy can do and can't do. That kind of rhetoric has been around for a long time. Maybe this kind of framework will put the spotlight more on that, where you really start to say, here are the fundamentals, and you've got to, these fundamentals have to change before you're going to get better macroeconomic outcomes.
Well, good. Well, this is a story that's going to run and run. I'm really indebted to you two gentlemen for being here today. Also, since this is now the end of our conference, I'd like to say a big thank you to the colleagues and the staff, the friends at the St. Louis Fed, who have been very, very helpful in putting together this conference over a number of months. Rachel Pine, who's a very dedicated member of the OMFIF team, a genuine New Yorker who's been leading the team in London to put this together over many, many months. And also, not least, the staff and the colleagues at Washington University, where you are an honorary professor, I believe, Jim, so you've got some very good links. A wonderful photographer who's been taking more pictures than Arnie Schwarzenegger normally has pictures taken of his. Thank you very much for all your service. Thank you, the staff, the catering staff, everybody who's been so helpful here. And last but not least, thank you all for coming, because it's been quite an arduous journey for quite a number of you through all sorts of storm-tossed skies. Thank you very much for coming and making it such a wonderful conference. Thank you.